delving deep into the interior world of your characters.
The inner dialogue is the thing that interests me. As far as I'm concerned, the plot is just an armature on which you hang that inner dialogue, because what interests me is consciousness, is how you go through the world, how you see the world, and how your consciousness makes little tiny adjustments and revisions based on every little stimulus that comes in. Someone says something, you hear something, you see something, and something happens to your consciousness. And that's what I was trying to do in these characters, is to get so deeply inside them that I could see the world the way they saw the world.
That's novelist Francine Prose. We talk with her about her acclaimed new novel, Mr. Monkey. It's terrific. Then we hear our 2006 interview with Prose about her book on writing, Reading Like a Writer. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net, also on PRX. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Francine Prose is an amazingly prolific writer. 18 novels, 3 short story collections, plus a myriad of essays, and even a children's book. We've already interviewed her on this show about 5 of her books, but as much as I've enjoyed her previous work, her latest novel, Mr. Monkey, is my favorite. You wouldn't think that a novel about a bad children's musical would be so entrancing, but it is. Filled with humanity, humor, and the kind of wisdom that comes from many decades of delving into the human condition, as all good novelists must. Plus, a happy ending. Mr. Monkey is a delight to read. The story follows a group of characters associated with an off-Broadway children's musical. Francine Prose tells the story from the viewpoints of her seemingly disparate characters whose lives become deeply connected as the madcap narrative unfolds. With her trademark wit and verve, Prose delves into humanity's most profound mysteries, art, ambition, childhood, aging, regret, and love. Francine Prose teaches literature at Bard College and is a former president of Penn American Center. I spoke with her about Mr. Monkey at her home in New York City. Well, Francine Prose, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
I've already told you that this is my favorite book of yours, and I have enjoyed all of them. But this one was very powerful, and you responded to me that it's very personal for you. Say a little bit more about that.
There are a number of characters of different ages, of widely different ages in the book. There's a 12-year-old boy, there's a middle-aged woman, there's a grandfather, there's a child. And each chapter is written from a different point of view for each of these characters. And in each case, I tried to put in what I knew or remembered or was about being that age and that character. So in other words, the grandfather is me, basically. I mean, I'm now a grandmother, and a lot of myself goes into that character. And then I try to put in what I remembered about being a 12-year-old. I mean, not a 12-year-old boy necessarily, but nonetheless a 12-year-old, and a middle-aged woman. So in every case, even though very few or maybe none of those characters would be readily identifiable as me, I felt like they all were me, so that it was very personal in that way. I mean, it was a series of totally disguised autobiographies.
Personal to you, but also I felt very personal to me. And so in that sense, universal. I mean, the grandfather character, I'm a grandmother also, and I could totally relate to how he feels, how in love he is with his grandson.
Yeah, it's a very obsessive relationship. I mean, people say, you always hear people say the same things, which is, it's so great, you can give them back. You know, you don't have to keep them 24 hours a day. But actually, it's a lot more complicated than that and a lot more obsessive than that. And I thought, well, this is something that hasn't really been written about, or I haven't seen it in fiction quite that way. So it was a lot of fun and also very satisfying to write that character and that chapter.
So let's not keep our listeners in suspense. Let's talk a little bit about the plot, maybe. Just give us an overview of the plot of this wonderful novel, Mr. Monkey.
Well, it starts in a theater in a production of a very bad children's musical based on a children's classic novel. And it's bad mostly because the budget is so low. And the actors are all, or most of them are talented in one way or another. Margot, the actress whose the first chapter is written from her point of view, was the star of her Yale Drama School class. She never expected that she'd be middle-aged and playing a lawyer defending a monkey in a children's musical. So it begins in that theater, and it ends more or less in that theater. And in between, I decided just to spin it out as far as I could. So the next chapter is from the point of view of the little boy who 12-year-old boy who plays the monkey. Then there's a chapter from the point of view of the grandfather who takes his grandson. Then from the grandson's point of view, then from the teacher, the kindergarten teacher of the grandson, and so forth. And I just knew that by the end, I wanted to bring it back full circle to the theater, so the last chapter is from the point of view of the director.
Now, there is a wonderful quote by Chekhov very early in the book. It's on page 20. I'm going to read it now. I felt it was very key to this novel, very key to the perspective that you take in the novel. It is, failures and disappointments make time go by so fast that you fail to notice your real life, and the past, when I was so free, seems to belong to someone else, not myself. Talk about this quote and the role it plays.
Well, Margot, the actress, receives an anonymous letter in the first chapter, which she imagines is from some admirer in the audience, a fan who's been following her work, and it has that Chekhov quote in it. And it's such a beautiful quote. It's such a beautiful quote. And also she says, you know, imagine Chekhov feeling that way, that he had all these failures and disappointments. Imagine how I feel if that's how Chekhov felt. And a lot of the novel is about the lives of people whose lives haven't exactly turned out the way they might have wished. So that quote is in some way or another pertinent to almost all the characters in the novel.
We once interviewed you about your book, Reading Like a Writer. So I wondered what Chekhov means to you. That book was about how writers taught you how to write. And in some way, I felt like Chekhov might have been at least partially amused in this book.
Chekhov's all over this book. I mean, there's that quote from Chekhov, and then Margot has been in her drama school production of Uncle Vanya, so there's a lot of thought about that play all the way through. And then there's a waiter named Mario who's fallen in love with the theater, and the production that made him such a convert to the theater was a production of Uncle Vanya. So in almost every chapter, there's something either about Chekhov or something that I like to think of as Chekhovian, because Chekhov had really the biggest heart, I think, of any great writer, and also the greatest ability to just get under the skin of characters who are not him, who are not like him, and also the most compassionate. I mean, when you read Chekhov, after you read enough Chekhov, you go out in the world, and at least briefly, you feel for everyone you see, because you know that Chekhov would have. So that was really kind of the spirit that I hoped was hovering over the novel, and that I was cultivating insofar as I could.
Well, you totally did that. In fact, I mean, my questions exactly go to that in my sense of this book. In fact, I write out some of my questions beforehand, and I say, this is a story with great compassion for its characters. And I felt the intimacy of the dialogue and how you did get under the skin. In fact, there was a kind of, one really had that sense that one, perhaps one only has about oneself, unless you are a novelist, you know, I always have this interior dialogue and then I'm aware of the face that I present to the world. And it's not a fake face, I mean, not in that sense, but there's a definite difference between the inner dialogue and the face I present. And that's also something you play with a lot in this book. I wonder if you could talk more about that.
Sure. I mean, I'm so glad you said that. The inner dialogue is the thing that interests me. The inner dialogue is, as far as I'm concerned, the plot is just an armature on which you hang that inner dialogue. Because what interests me is consciousness, is how you go through the world, how you see the world, and how your consciousness makes little tiny adjustments and revisions based on every little stimulus that comes in. Someone says something, you hear something, you see something, and something happens to your consciousness. And that's what I was trying to do in these characters, is to get so deeply inside them that I could see the world the way they saw the world.
Yeah, so maybe talk a little bit about Adam. Adam, the name of the first man who plays the monkey, this 12-year-old boy, because in some ways he's almost the most striking character. How you do that?
He's a 12-year-old boy. He's a gymnast. He wants to be an actor. He's having a sudden burst of what I suppose you could call hormonal problems. He is the son of a woman named Giselle, single mom, and a stage mom. And I've always been kind of very curious about stage mothers because, I don't know, somehow I think that all mothers basically are stage mothers, but we've just learned how to hide it better than they do. So he's under a lot of pressure. He's under a great deal of pressure. And he's playing a monkey in this production, and he has a huge crush on Margot, the actress, even though she's, I don't know, what, 30 years older than he is. So, and he's trying to deal with all these things at once, his home life, his school life, his lack of school life, he's being homeschooled, and his little professional life. So he's under a lot of strain.
And those, those hormonal urges, one has great sympathy for him, ultimately, although Margot does not.
Well, he indulges in what I guess now it turns out every kindergartner knows is inappropriate behavior, so which is threatening to the cast, obviously. And you certainly wouldn't want to be on stage with Adam doing what Adam is doing. But nonetheless, again, it was a challenge to get inside him to see how all these things he was doing looked from his point of view.
Mm. Yes. And then Margot, you've said a little bit about her. Of course, her regrets, that comes up with the Chekhovian quote. She also has to wear this bizarre costume. And I wonder if you could describe it and then tell me, how did this appear?
She's playing, as I said, the lawyer who is defending the monkey. The monkey, Mr. Monkey, has this kind of party trick, which is stealing wallets from guests at the party. And the evil girlfriend of his adoptive father accuses him of actually stealing her wallet. So he's being tried at taxpayer expense for larceny. And Margot is playing Portia, the lawyer who's defending him. And she's being made to wear a kind of synthetic purple suit, tiny little hobblingly short skirt that turns red in the light, and a rainbow Harpo Marx wig. So it's humiliating. But her costume really came about because I saw a production that was not Mr. Monkey. I mean, I invented Mr. Monkey, but it was way not Mr. Monkey, but it was a children's musical, and it was also very low budget. And the first thing that struck me was how obviously the costumes were falling apart. And my heart just went out to these actors wearing these kind of threadbare costumes. So that's, in a way, the novel started with Margot's costume as much as anything else.
And it seemed that in that humiliation, I mean, the humiliation of having to wear this this comic costume is part of the baggage that she's carrying with her, but she really does come to be a person of great dignity.
And there's a happy ending. She has a happy ending, so which I never expected when I was writing it, but I was very glad to see that happen. So there's hope for Margot.
Well, yeah, you said that the plot was something, it's a structure on which to hang the inner dialogue of the characters, but I thought the plot was really perfect, and of course we're not going to give anything away, but it just, that happy ending just seems so right, and for me, as a reader, it's what made, it was part of the great satisfaction in reading the book. So could you talk a little bit about happy endings versus sad endings as a writer?
Well, I always used to. I mean, the ending is the ending. It's very hard for me to think of it as I'm working in any sort of abstract term, happy, sad, and blah, blah. But I always found myself writing indeterminate endings because they seemed more lifelike to me. I mean, the ending of Chekhov's, again, The Lady with the Pet Dog, which is, and they realized that the hardest part was still ahead of them. That seemed to me the perfect ending because, unless you're writing about a story that ends in death, that's the ending. But this novel, Mr. Monkey, this happy ending just kind of appeared on the page. And I went, oh, okay, I can figure out how this would work and why this would work. And I was thrilled when I got there. I mean, I hadn't been planning it, but I couldn't have been more delighted.
Now, back to Adam. He is the 12-year-old. He's not only going through the throes of puberty, but he's also going through, I think, a very contemporary and perhaps even more intense for us today, very contemporary concerns, which is really kind of about the end of the world. He lives down on Battery Park City, and he looks out his window, which has a wonderful view of the Hudson, and all he can see is...
Well, he has a fantasy of apocalypse, of climate apocalypse, really. But, you know, and that came because... I remember during Hurricane Sandy that the people who lived in Battery Park City were very affected by it. And, you know, much of the west side there is landfill. So it's always kind of problematic. So, and now when I look at that part of the city, I think, you know, I think about the water, really, which is what he thinks about. So I can imagine looking out Adam's window and thinking about that. But also I think one of the things that I was doing, kids are very aware of all this stuff. They're very aware. I mean, kids know about climate change, whether adults admit that it's real or not. They study it in school. They're not dummies. They're very alert. So Adam's fears about all this just reflect the fears of kids I know.
Mm. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with author Francine Prose, novelist Francine Prose, about her latest novel, Mr. Monkey. And even he's not the only one. I mean, there's a marvelous scene in a restaurant which occurs, where even climate change comes up there, and in the voice of a character who's not particularly sympathetic. He's a little bit older. He's an adult. But he expresses really, and you name it, nail it, a kind of nihilism. And it's something that I'm a nihilism that's based on climate apocalypse, on global warming. It's something I'm actually seeing come up in a lot of fiction these days. And I don't mean fiction that is specifically about global warming. I don't mean speculative fiction. I mean that this is a theme I'm seeing over and over again come up. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your relationship to those thoughts, how intrusive they are, how they work into your own fiction writing.
Well, there are a lot of dystopic novels being written. But, you know, I mean, I was thinking the other day about childhood, and I was thinking that I'd been a kind of fearful child when I was growing up. And I thought, well, thank goodness I became a writer because I found something to do with these fears, you know, that channel them into my work. I think we're all nervous about it, and I think we'd be really foolish not to be worried about it. And when you sit down to write, what do you do with your fears? They have to crop up in your work sooner or later. So it's no surprise that these dystopic fantasies keep coming up, because it's hard not to have them.
And in working with them in your work, is that also a way to confront them, or to, I mean, is that anxiety just stay there, or is it in some way a working out of it?
No, it just stays there. I mean, I wish we were working out of it, like, you know, oh, thank goodness I put climate apocalypse in my novel so I don't have to worry about it anymore. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, it's a reflection. I wish it were some sort of solution, but it isn't.
Sometimes I fantasize, or I think about people 300 years hence unearthing the literature of this time and seeing all the references to what they know has happened as coming, and saying, you know, here, it was all there. How come they didn't do anything about it?
I know. Well, that's the 300 years hence human beings is kind of the optimistic way of looking at things. I mean, I try not to imagine what I keep calling the Mad Max scenario of, you know, global struggles over water. But it's hard to see what that future is going to be. And, you know, again, as a grandparent or as a human being, forget that, you know, you do worry about what's going to happen to the kids now, babies being born, and what are they going to inherit?
So you have said, I have told you, as I've already said, that this is my favorite book. You've said that it's yours. What was it like to write it? I'm thinking of the word flow, you know, the way people, when they are really at their peak and things are working very well, I wonder if flow was something that was going on with you as you were writing this.
It was fun. It was a great deal of fun. Also because by the end of each chapter, I'd kind of figure out who was going to narrate the next chapter, because always someone interested me in that chapter. I mean, when I finished the first chapter and two things happened. One was I knew that I was going to have to write a chapter from Adam's point of view, since he commits the little mini act of sexual aggression in the first chapter. And also because by the end of the first chapter, the grandfather and the grandson have appeared in the story. So I knew that I was going to have to do something from their point of view. So, you know, it was like watching this baton get passed from hand to hand. And I was just taking, you know, at the very best moments, it really does feel like taking dictation. Like you're just sitting there and you're hearing these voices coming from these characters telling you who they are. And there were quite a number of moments like that where I just thought, okay, all I have to do really is listen.
That's wonderful. So the grandfather and the boy, they appear in the theater in a scene. I was really trying to puzzle it out a little bit. The boy says, he turns to his grandfather right in a moment of silence where, you know, the action on the stage is frozen for a minute and the audience is silent, and he says something like to his grandfather, "Are you interested in this, grandfather?" And I was trying to puzzle out, where did that come from? Was that a voice that just came through? And what, that begins a whole series of plot points in the book. How did that scene happen?
No, that was direct autobiography. My granddaughter said in the middle of a play, not unlike Mr. Monkey, and again in what she thought was a noisy moment, but was a quiet moment, "Grandma, are you interested in this?" And I said very loud, "Yes." And that's really how the book started. I mean, she now thinks we wrote the book together, which in a way we did. She refers to it as our monkey book and, you know, asked me how it's doing and so forth. So, yeah, that was real.
Oh, that's lovely. And were you interested?
I was certainly very interested, although maybe not for the reasons that the actors might have preferred.
Is there an excerpt from the book that you like to read or that you read in places?
Sure. Well, let me just begin at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And this is from Margot's point of view. It's how the book begins. Who cares if it's children's theater? Margot is playing a criminal lawyer crusading for truth and justice. So would someone please tell her where, in what deranged fashion universe, a defense attorney would appear before a judge in a rainbow Harpo Marx wig and an obscenely short, hobblingly tight, iridescent purple suit? Margot arrives at the theater an hour early, since part of her preparation now involves a series of meditations designed to help her overcome the humiliation of squeezing into an outfit that her character, Portia McBailey, would never wear unless she'd quit being a lawyer and gone to work for an escort service, role-playing a slutty executive secretary, birthday clown. Now, as she enters her dressing room before the Saturday matinee, she notices that the hem of the purple skirt has come entirely undone. The dimpled fringe of ragged cloth trailing clumps of thread will hypnotize the audience. "Mommy, Daddy, why is that funny lady's skirt so hairy?" Margot counts off 10 deep breaths so as to repel any negative thoughts that might otherwise collect around Lakshmi, the overworked, underpaid NYU Drama Department graduate student who is the costume department.
Yes, so starts with her. I'd like to go back to end by going back to that theme of compassion. I suppose an author, a novelist, probably has compassion for most of their characters, although maybe that's not true all the time, because sometimes people write quite horrendous characters, but I was struck by the compassion that you had for every single one of these.
Yeah, well, there's only one unsympathetic character, and that's the guy, the kindergarten teacher goes on a really awful first date, and the guy, actually, who you kind of refer to, the one who has a kind of nihilistic attitude toward climate apocalypse, is the guy she goes on the blind date with, and he's the only unsympathetic character. But someone asked me, I mean, the last chapter in the novel belongs to Roger, the director, and someone said to me, why did you know that you had to end with Roger? And I said, because Roger is the most despised. They're the most, Roger's, everyone's been dumping on him all the way through the novel. They've been complaining because of the costumes he makes them wear and the things and so forth. And to humanize everyone, I knew that I was going to have to end with a character who might be more, the most difficult to humanize. And hence, we ended with Roger.
Yeah. Yeah, it was beautiful. And that scene in the restaurant with the date who's such a jerk, I have to say, that was one of the most satisfying group of pages, because something happens and the kindergarten teacher comes out and she really lays into him, and it's a beautiful scene.
Yeah, I saw a version of that take place many years ago, but it was before texting. It was someone... It was a blind date next to us in a restaurant, and when the woman went to the bathroom, the guy called his friend who had set him up to complain about the date. So, but unfortunately, because it wasn't texting and because the woman didn't know that he'd done this, she didn't have that moment of telling the guy off because she didn't know what had happened. So I thought, whenever I put this in a novel, she's going to get her revenge or get her... justice, really. So that's why it ended that way.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't mentioned the author of Mr. Monkey.
Yeah, the author of Mr. Monkey. Mr. Monkey, the novel, was written by a guy named Ray, a Puerto Rican Vietnam vet, who thought he was writing a novel for adults, and then his editor told him that it might be work better as a children's novel, something no writer wants to hear. But it's worked out quite well for Ray. He's lived off Mr. Monkey for 25 years now, and although he despises the musical, every time he gets a royalty check, it's a kind of tradition to use that money to go out to dinner, which serves as a bridge between the kindergarten teacher and the waiter. So that's how it kind of all fits together, that part of the novel.
Yes, and the novel is Mr. Monkey. We've been talking with the author, Francine Prose. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You can read and hear excerpts from Mr. Monkey by going to writersvoice.net. Next, we re-air our 2006 interview with Francine Prose about her book, Reading Like a Writer. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with novelist, essayist, and short story writer Francine Prose. As I said at the top of this hour, she is an abundantly prolific writer who has appeared often on our show. The first time we spoke with her was in 2006 about her book about writing, Reading Like a Writer. Here's that interview again. What's the best way to learn how to write? Some think it's by subjecting yourself to the critiques of an expert writing teacher and fellow students in an MFA writing program. And I'm sure that that can be very helpful. But Francine Prose has a more enjoyable suggestion, at least to my taste, and that is read the works of great writers to get a sense of how to write, say, a good sentence or dialogue or develop a character. Prose has authored 14 books of fiction, including Blue Angel, which was a finalist for the National Book Award. She's been teaching literature and writing for more than 20 years at such places as Harvard and Columbia, among others, and she also writes criticism and essays. I spoke to her about her new book, Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Your book, Reading Like a Writer, grew out of what you learned about teaching creative writing, is that right?
Well, it did. I mean, it grew out of my own education as a writer and the years I spent teaching writing and also my own feeling about reading.
Say more about the process of teaching, per se, and then how you brought your own personal experience together with what you thought was good for your students.
Well, you know, I took undergraduate creative writing workshops, but I don't, in fact, have an MFA. So I really learned to write the way most of the writers I know learn to write, which is by reading. And, you know, essentially I learned by studying who did certain things well. And I always tell my students that what you develop is kind of mental Rolodex. So if you're getting to the point where you want to write a certain kind of scene, a scene of violence or a party scene or a kind of family dinner, then you can go to the writer that you know does that thing beautifully and learn it from that. I mean, teaching writing and the writing workshop is so often based on what one of your peers and fellow students has done wrong. So you go through the story and talk about it in class, and you try and figure out how to fix the thing that's broken. But the other possibility for learning is to look at someone whose work is not broken at all, who is really a genius at doing it, and figure out how it's done when it's done well.
So teaching by example rather than by critique.
Exactly.
Well, you take up the anatomy of being a writer by taking up in your different chapters things like words, sentences, paragraphs, narration, character, dialogue, details, and gesture, which I think is a marvelous way to organize a book of this kind, and using different examples to do that. In fact, your examples just absolutely have me salivating to read all those books.
Well, it was so much fun to find the examples, and then part of what I loved about writing the book was actually typing those examples into the manuscript. I mean, for example, there's that great, the first sentence of Virginia Woolf's On Being Ill is 141 words long, a single sentence, 141 words. And when I would type something like that into the manuscript, and you know, that sentence is just a model of clarity and precision and beauty and grace and rhythm and style and elegance, I typed Virginia Woolf's sentence into the manuscript, and then very briefly, I found that my own writing would get better as a consequence of just having typed those examples. So, you know, it was just fun to sort of go to my library and say, you know, who does this well, who does that well? And as I say in the book, I wrote the book like Tom Sawyer Painting the Fence, because I would talk to or email all my friends who are writers and say, okay, who's your favorite dialogue writer, or who do you think is a master at doing narration? And then I would use their examples. I mean, I credit them at the end of the book. But for example, when I was writing the chapter on paragraphs, and it was kind of amazing to me. I mean, a few pages in, I realized that no one, as far as I knew, had really written about paragraphs before. I mean, you see it in of course, grammar books and style books. But in terms of, you know, writing books, it's just somehow taken for granted, whereas, in fact, the paragraph is the most basic, important unit. So one writer friend, David Gates, said, well, you should look at this Rick Stout mystery, because Nero Wolfe solves a plagiarism case by using paragraphs. He says, you know, no two writers paragraph the same way, and that's so then when I began looking at it and seeing who does certain kinds of paragraphs, it was incredibly instructive for me as well. I mean, I felt that I was a better writer at the end of writing the book just by having looked at those examples.
Give us some examples of the different authors' kinds of paragraphs that you have in the book.
Well, for example, there's the one sentence paragraph. I mean, which I caution writers and readers to be very careful, because it can be, you know, very hokey and a way of kind of infusing artificial energy or giving a kind of meaningfulness to something. You know, a friend of mine refers to one sentence paragraphs as like a poke in the ribs. But then there are writers. I mean, Raymond Carver is an obvious example, who uses one-sentence paragraphs beautifully, or, you know, the much longer paragraphs that you might find in a Jane Austen novel. And the thing is, you know, one of the things I say in the book, and which is so true to me, is that your education as a writer is ongoing. So now, you know, now that the book is done and out, I keep finding other stories, examples, that I wish I had used and known about. I mean, there's a marvelous Leonard Michael story that has these very, very, very long paragraph, and then near the end, one single one-sentence paragraph that's just a kind of killer.
You know, I want to come back to the long paragraphs, but first I just thought for our listeners, since it's short, we could read the Raymond Carver story paragraphs that you talk about. I'd like to have you read other things, but I think I'm going to read this just because it's so quick.
Oh, sure. I'd love to hear you read it.
Okay, so here are two paragraphs from Raymond Carver's story, Fat. It is August. My life is going to change. I feel it. So say something more about that. What makes those paragraphs okay? They're not only one sentence, but one of them is just three words.
Well, the strange thing about it, and really it's the marvel of Raymond Carver, is that you feel that those paragraphs are just, you know, a cry from the character's soul. They're the truest thing that the character can think of to say. And of course, yeah, it's August, but in fact, that life is not going to change. So, you know, it's true and it's not true, and it's just the most heartfelt expression of what that character is capable of.
Hmm. Now, you actually take on a lot of shibboleths in this book, one of them being that there are no rules. You say that at the end in a wonderful chapter on courage, which we'll talk about later on. For example, you disagree with the idea that writers always have to show, not tell. I know my editor, I'm a journalist as well as a radio host, a radio journalist, and of course, in radio, you really do have to show more than you can tell because you don't have much time to tell anything. But nonetheless, this is the advice that's always given to writers. And tell us why that's not always true.
Well, I have to say that I've never exactly understood what it means. I assume what people mean is that you have to kind of dramatize or give examples or something. But if you look at the great writers, if you look, again, at Jane Austen or Melville or, you know, writers of this century, too, they're just telling all the time. I mean, it's narration. So, in other words, if you say a certain character is angry, you don't have to show him, you know, tearing his hair and punching himself in the head and so on. It's perfectly fine to just say, you know, blah, blah was angry. I mean, there are plenty of things in which narration does the job perfectly well and rivets the reader's attention without having to act everything out.
Well, also, you mentioned the word narration. I think one of the great pleasures I often have in reading is hearing the voice of the narrator, which is, after all, telling more than showing.
Right, and you know, when I was writing the chapter on narration, you know, the book was an education for me to write as well, and I began to realize that, you know, people talk, for example, of the omniscient third-person narrator as if it were impartial, as if it had no personality, as if it were just, you know, the voice of God. But in fact, the omniscient third-person narrator often has a very distinct personality and a very distinct point of view. So it was really fun to go through and say, use an example from Flannery O'Connor in which the omniscient third-person narrator has a very distinct point of view. I mean, and when you actually start looking at it, many third-person narrators have a voice, have a particular voice. Or, you know, the whole question of third-person narration, what is it like? I mean, one of the things I say in the book is that, you know, people often say that the central question is, what's the voice? Who's telling the story? But in fact, what I realize the question is who's the story being told to? So as I say in Reading Like a Writer, I tricked myself into writing at the beginning by writing one of those stories and novels that people don't do anymore, which is, you know, frame stories in which we actually know who's talking and who's telling a story and who's listening. I mean, those stories like, you know, Turgenev's First Love or Tolstoy's The Kreutzer Sonata, in which you actually observe one character telling the story that is the novel or the story to another character.
Do you have the book there?
I do.
I wonder if there's, you know, as you're mentioning them, I'm just wondering if we can give our listeners a little taste of what you're talking about, for example, with this framed story.
Sure. Well, what about just reading this section about Wuthering Heights? That could be...
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay. For every reader who remembers Kathy and Heathcliff scrambling over the moors, many will have forgotten that the novel is constructed like a series of Russian nesting dolls. On the outside, we have Mr. Lockwood, who is renting property from Mr. Heathcliff for a temporary stay, and who has exactly as much at stake in his surroundings as is often found among those who rent instead of owning. After a number of startling incidents involving a plaintive ghost, a diary, and his landlord's alarmingly dysfunctional family, Lockwood persuades Nellie, the housekeeper, to tell him the history of the place and of several generations of the house's inhabitants. Though she herself has been deeply involved in the events that have occurred at the estate, Nellie has, except for Lockwood and the nearly subverbal servant Joseph, the lowest emotional stake in the family's tragic history. Thus, she is the most credible witness to the happenings that at moments are not merely dramatic but positively gothic, with all the sublime and supernatural trappings of the gothic romance. Her voice is one of pure narrative, unintrusive and uninflective, and using her to tell the tale allows Emily Bronte to ground these improbable happenings in everyday reality, or at least the reality that can be found at Wuthering Heights.
Right. Yeah, that's a wonderful example. And I found myself reading that paragraph actually several times because it's rich in itself. It's quite complex, and it leads one along from point to point in a beautiful example, I think, of what a good paragraph should do.
Thank you so much. Well, you know, again, as I said, you know, once I started writing these things, you know, it's, in a way, it's like becoming conscious of your blinking or something. Once I started writing these things, then I was even more aware of what a paragraph is and how the paragraph should work. I mean, you know, it becomes instinctive as you're writing and as you write over the years, but I would look back and say, oh, that's how a paragraph is constructed.
Right. If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Francine Prose about her book, Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Well, I'd like to turn to sentences. I love the reference that you make to how writers talk about sentences, the way mathematicians might share admiration for an obscure theorem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of my own personal favorite writer of sentences, who I don't think is in the book, and that's W.G. Sebald.
Oh, yes, I know.
And he violates all rules about brevity.
I know. Those long, sinuous, gorgeous sentences. You know, but again, there's this tradition of, you know, he's writing very much in the European tradition, and there's the tradition of, you know, like the Kleist sentences that are so marvelous. I mean, you know, that great sentence, it's the opening of the Marquise of O. You know, it's just extraordinary. It's just one surprise after the other. I mean, the other day I was teaching to an undergraduate class Kafka's Metamorphosis, which of course has that great opening sentence, and Kafka claimed to have learned to write opening sentences from Kleist, and he certainly has these marvelous sentences.
I think a lot of our listeners may not know who Kleist is. Do you want to tell us?
Yeah, sure. Or maybe actually I could
read that
strange little part.
That would be great.
I realized that it was a bit of a gamble when, in the late 1980s, I assigned my undergraduate class at the University of Utah to read Heinrich von Kleist's novella, The Marquise of O. None of my students was a literature major. Most were Mormons. Few had ever left Utah, and not a single one had ever heard of Heinrich von Kleist. If they'd known him, he would have scared them silly. They were bright, scrubbed, optimistic American kids, and he was a tormented German hypochondriac who, when he wasn't writing works of genius, was contemplating suicide and longing only for what he called an abyss deep enough to jump into. Eventually, he met a terminally ill woman whom he recognized as a soulmate. Their rapturous connection was forged by the shared dream of double suicide, which they finally committed in 1811 in Berlin on the shore of Lake Wannsee. Regardless of Kleist's sad history, I thought my students might like his novella, which isn't all that long, and which has a grabby switchbacking plot that pulls you right in right away, with its famous first sentence. In M, a large town in northern Italy, the widowed Marquise of O, a lady of unblemished reputation, and the mother of several well-bred children, published the following notice in the newspapers, that, without her knowing how, she was in the family way, that she would like the father of the child she was going to bear to report himself, and that her mind was made up, out of consideration for her people, to marry him. Now that's just the greatest first sentence ever written. I mean, one sentence, you know, clauses and semicolons and so forth, there's a dash in there. But how could you possibly not read on after reading that sentence?
Why do you say it's the greatest? I mean, there's certainly lots of sentences
I know.
So what's got the special punch of that one for you?
Well, it's got a whole, you know, it's got more in that first sentence than most stories have in the entire story. It's so compressed, it's so informative, and it's so profoundly strange that it just, you know, introduces you to a whole other world and the beginning of a whole kind of a whole different consciousness that you find yourself in as you're reading the story.
Could you say more about that?
Well, you know, the story basically is about how you accept the improbable, how you respond to the miraculous, what an angel is, what a devil is, and all the way through. I mean, here's a woman, you know, one of the points of making it clear in the very first sentence that she's the mother of several children already is that she knows perfectly well how children are conceived and born. So for her to say she doesn't know how this happened is kind of mind-bending already. Or, you know, to say that she's a lady of unblemished reputation also means that she really isn't covering up an adulterous romance. So how could such a thing be possible?
Now, sentence fragments are okay, too, kind of going to the other extreme.
Well, sure. Then you get Philip Roth, who just, you know, writes these extraordinary sentence fragments because it's the, you know, it's kind of the energetic rat-a-tat-tat of that kind of language on the page.
Yeah, and so you mentioned the difference between American and European writers. Why this difference? Why can Europeans seem to accept long, long sentences and Americans don't?
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer because many years ago I was teaching a graduate class, and I did teach von Kleist's The Marquise of O, and I said to my students, look at these sentences. They're perfectly clear. They're very, very long, complex sentences. And this was, I guess it was the early 90s, but it was when writers like Raymond Carver were still really in their heyday, and many of my students wanted to write like Raymond Carver. And they said to me, yes, 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 but this is from the German, and we're writing in English. And I had to point out to them that actually we were reading it in English and not in German, and it made perfect sense. So it is possible to construct complex sentences in English, and other writers do it. I mean, you know, there's Stanley Elkins certainly wrote these extraordinary, long, complex sentences, and they're perfectly lucid.
Well, let's move on to character. You actually used Kleist as the example for your chapter on character.
Mm-hmm.
And well, first, actually, before I ask you that, how did your students respond to the Kleist story?
They loved it. They just loved it. I mean, you know, as I say in Reading Like a Writer, I walked into class on the day it was being taught, and I was very nervous because in addition to being, you know, to having complex senses, Kleist is the most irreverent writer in a certain way, and part of the kind of joke or the paradox of the Marquise of O has to do with the virgin birth, and you know, my students were religious. And they loved it. I walked in, and they were all talking about the Marquise of O and her various family members as if they were neighbors, as if they were people who lived next door, as if they knew them. And that was what was so moving to me, was here was Kleist having led his tormented, awful life and killed himself. And, you know, hundreds of years later, here were these kids, these Mormon kids in Utah, reading his work and responding so freshly and directly and with such, you know, a kind of emotional response to something he created just by putting words down on the page.
Oh, that's a great story. So how did you use him in your teaching about character?
Well, just to take one example, you never know what the characters in Kleist look like. He doesn't bother with physical description. I mean, you know, for example, that the Marquise is quite beautiful because of the way people around her are reacting to her. But, you know, one thing, again, you know, the question of rules of what people are told to do when they're writing or what they're told in writing workshop. I mean, they're often told, well, you have to describe the character. When you read Kleist, you think, well, maybe it's not necessary to describe the character. Or later, you know, in the Writing for Courage chapter, I talk about Beckett. I mean, if you read Beckett's First Love, you certainly never know what the narrator looks like. You don't know most of the most basic things about him, and yet you know enough.
Yeah, in fact, that was one of the paragraphs I'd like to have you read. It's on page 257.
On 251.
251, that's it.
Right.
Yes, that paragraph.
The opening paragraph is remarkable for many reasons, one of which is the speed with which it alerts us to the strangeness of the reading experience that lies ahead. And this is the opening paragraph of Beckett's First Love. I associate, rightly or wrongly, my marriage with the death of my father in time. That other links exist on other planes between these two affairs is not impossible. I have enough trouble in trying to say what I think I know.
Yeah, and then just read on a little bit.
Okay. The fact that we get sex and death in the very first sentence is the least of it somehow. What's startling is the voice, as unsettling now as it must have been when the story was written in 1950, though it did not appear in English translation until almost 25 years later. By now, we've grown used to seeing on the page the operations of human consciousness, the interior rat-tat-tat that monitors and responds to the world. But rarely before, one notable exception is Dostoevsky, have we heard a voice we recognize from our own darkest hours, our own most uncertain, disassociated, and alienated moments, a mind that, from the opening sentence, begins correcting itself and expressing doubt about the most basic facts. So far, the narrator has spent more time telling us what he cannot say and doesn't know than saying what he does know.
Yes, and you say that Beckett violates the rule that you're supposed to like your character. And although, actually, I'd never heard of this rule. I thought there's an awful lot of literature in which people hate the character.
Oh, of course. But, you know, it comes up, sadly, more often in book reviews than it does in writing classes, I think. I mean, you read reviews that say, well, I just didn't like, you know, blah, blah novel because there were no sympathetic characters in it. Well, in fact, there are plenty of great novels. I mean, Raskolnikov, I suppose he's a very sympathetic character, but still, you know, he murders two women for no good reason pretty near the opening of Crime and Punishment. So is that sympathetic? It's not quite clear.
Compelling might be a word that I would rather use than likable or sympathetic.
Yeah, or interesting even.
Right. Okay, now dialogue. And you say that a lot of written dialogue is less interesting than real speech.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we're cautioned in the writing classes against writing real speech.
Yeah, well, people say that because people repeat themselves and they hesitate and they make little meaningless syllables and so forth, that writing on the page should be smoother and clearer and cleaner than written speech. But in fact, when you actually eavesdrop, which is something I tell students to do, you hear people do the most marvelous things in their conversation and tell stories, and you're aware, which you should be aware of when you're reading dialogue or writing dialogue, of subtext, of what people are not saying, of what they really mean, of who they're talking to, of how different they sound when they're talking to one person or another person, of how differently they listen. I mean, all those things, when you read a great dialogue writer, I mean, Henry Green is the example I use, you realize how much you can do with dialogue when you're writing it.
Yeah, and you say eavesdrop. So what's most important? Is it that ear in terms of example, the conversations that you hear, or perhaps a dialogue that you might read in a book that was good with its dialogue? Or is it understanding or getting under the skin of the character more important?
I think both those things happen at once. I mean, the ear is extremely important. And Richard Price, for example, is another writer that you can go to, or Scott Spencer, who just write marvelous dialogue because, A, they have a great ear for dialogue, and B, they're extremely aware of all the kind of tensions and little bits of subtext and what the characters are trying to do when they're talking besides simply talk. And you can really learn from that.
Finally, the last chapter, which is Reading for Courage, and I think this is the one that, you know, really strikes right to the heart of so many of us who, I mean, I know that I've sat for days in front of a blank screen just trying to summon up my courage from where it's hidden somewhere. Talk about that. Talk about what is so fearful sometimes about writing and how reading can help us overcome that.
Well, I think that when you sit down to write, they're all different, many, many different fears. You fear, what if someone found out what I was really like? Or what if someone knew that I thought this? Or what if my mother read this? Or, you know, what about if I wrote about my Uncle Bill and somebody noticed that that's what I was doing? And when you read great writers, you realize people have done it, and they've survived, and they've contributed to the world, and they've made art out of that. And a lot of those fears are dissipated by reading. I mean, also, because people are so often told, now, you can't do this in writing, you can't do this in literature, you're not supposed to do this, and you read writing that's so strange and so original. I mean, the whole point is to do something that hasn't been done before rather than do exactly what people have been doing. It's tremendously encouraging. You think, oh, I can do this, there's a reason for me to do this, and I want to do it.
And that was Francine Prose talking to us about her book, Reading Like a Writer, and that's published by HarperCollins Press. And that interview aired first on Writer's Voice in 2006. Now, here's a short clip from the latest episode in our new online series, What You Need to Know. We spoke with Frances Moore LePay, author of the iconic Diet for a Small Planet, and founder and director of the Small Planet Institute, along with her colleague Adam Eichen. We spoke about their new field guide to the democracy movement. It's a tool for people everywhere who want to protect and expand democracy in this time when it's under threat. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.